spent any time in the book of Proverbs lately? When's the last time you read some of the book of Proverbs? If you have and you've read from chapter 10 and beyond, often when you read that book, they're a collection of sayings, and you feel like you have one verse that says one thing, and the next verse says another thing, and you kind of feel jolted back and forth, and maybe you take just a verse or two at a time. But if you do some work in the book of Proverbs, you find that often those sayings are actually grouped together thematically. They have something in common, and they're looking at things from different angles, and the real trick is trying to discover which verses go together and how that theme is being extrapolated in those various sayings. Well, there's much discussion about this fourth chapter in the book of Ecclesiastes. Are these verses related? Are these just various topics? Do they have any kind of theme to them? In fact, if you read the commentary literature, some of them say that Solomon's thought from chapter 3 actually runs all the way into chapter 4 and verse 3. And then he picks up a different thought, and there's a different thought at the end of the chapter. And they might be right. It's a very difficult chapter, actually, to structurally outline and define. But I think that there is some keys and some clues for us to know that this is a chapter and these verses do belong together. One of the ways that you can discern that is the repetition of ideas, even the repetition of words. And there's a word that occurs frequently in these verses that maybe you picked up on that tells us they're tied together. That word is, if you'll notice verse 3, it's the word better. And if you'll notice verse 6, better. And if you'll notice verse 9, two are better. And verse 13, better was a poor and wise youth. And this is typical in this kind of genre, wisdom literature, that the speaker is looking at things from one angle and then he says, but this is better, and this is another angle by which to look at this, and he's making comparison of these things. And so I do think that it's good to take chapter 4 as a whole unit together in that there's kind of a play on this word and he's describing certain things and what's better than others. But I think there's also an overarching thread that seems to connect all the things that we just read in chapter 4. And the overarching theme, the thread that kind of runs through all of that, is the fact that he's talking about human relationships under the sun. That living this side of eternity under the sun, we all engage in human relations. And those human relations are often strained and difficult. And he notes even some of the atrocities that occur in human relationships on this planet. And he gives some indications that there are some things better than others. But again, remember the whole point of his book is this, that life without God is empty. Even in all the human relationships that you look for on this earth and that you hold, if you're looking for satisfaction in those, in the end, they're empty. Because they can't satisfy. In fact, without God in the picture, they tend to run along the particular lines that are being discussed in this chapter. And so, as we continue our study in Ecclesiastes this morning, I'd like to speak to you on this topic, human relations under the sun. And we're going to note four things, really, that Solomon points out here for us in chapter 4 in regard to human relationships. How he describes the difficulty in human relationships. But there are some things that are better, but none of them ultimately satisfy. And so let's pray, and we'll ask God to help us see what is here. Lord, thank you for your word, and help us to see it in light of eternity today. I pray that it would be clear, that we would understand what relationships do look like often in our experience, especially when God is not in the picture and we are not thriving in a relationship with you and the way that tends to be played out in our lives with one another here on this earth. So give us your wisdom, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen. Have you heard about the hermit who tried to start a hermit's association in his neighborhood? He scheduled a meeting, said this was the time. After the meeting, he sat down and opened up his notebook and said this: "It was really nice. Nobody showed up. I think I'm onto something." Well, no one can avoid human relationships, nor should we. Oftentimes we think we would like to because they tend to be messy and difficult. But the Bible actually has a lot to say about human relationships under the sun. And Solomon points out here in this fourth chapter some troubling trends with regard to our relationship with other human beings on this planet. I'm going to note them for us. We'll go through, I'll describe them a bit. And then at the end, I think we'll wrap them up together with some concluding thoughts and application for us this morning. I want to note four troubling trends in human relationships under the sun. The first of these is in the first three verses, and that is this. It's the pain of human relations marked by oppression. Look with me at verse 1. He says, "Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. Behold, the tears of the oppressed. They had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them." What is oppression? Oppression is simply seeking after personal profit without regard to the nature or needs or rights of other people. It's using my power and my strength, be it financial or political or even intellectual, in order to put down other people, to gain an advantage over them. When the Bible speaks of oppression, it speaks of it in various contexts. It speaks of the oppression of people by a king, how a ruler can oppress his people. In the book of Deuteronomy, it speaks of oppression of a servant by his master, that somehow the master in the position of power really heaps an oppression upon those that serve him. In the book of Proverbs, in the 22nd chapter, oppression is spoken of the poor by the affluent. Those that have all the money and therefore all the power are able to work the system in a way that advantages them and disadvantages the poor. In the book of Deuteronomy, or rather in the book of Proverbs again, is talking about the oppression of poor people by other poor people. It's not just a class distinction, but it can happen even within a class. The books of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, we're told of the oppression of the alien or foreigner and the fatherless and the widow, that these are people in a vulnerable position coming into a country, and therefore they can easily be oppressed. The book of Ezekiel again talks about oppression by charging high interest rates on people who are in need of a loan. Oppression is the abuse of power, financial and otherwise, perpetrated on those that aren't so powerful and indeed are vulnerable. And the Bible especially looks at those vulnerable people in these categories: the widow, the orphan, and the poor. And Solomon says in his reign as king and in his life on this earth, he looks out among the humanity that maybe he ruled and maybe even those beyond his kingdom, and he notes their condition and he says, "I've noticed that oppression happens regularly. It happens frequently." And he bemoans this condition when he says this of the oppressed: they had no one to comfort them. It seemed as if there was no way out of their oppression. These are people that feel so trampled down by others in this world that they go home and cry themselves to sleep at night. They don't know where to turn because they are constantly abused by others. You say, we're a modern country. Things like that don't happen in our world. Well, we all know better. Just last century, you're probably familiar with the Khmer Rouge under the leadership of a man named Pol Pot. He was a leader in Cambodia, and in an attempt to make a Cambodian master race, systematically killed over 2 million people. Genocide. Oppressor. All I have to do is mention the name Adolf Hitler or Eichmann, and you know the oppression that they perpetrated upon the Jewish people. And these are thoughts of systemic oppression that occur in a society, but we know that oppression occurs on a more personal, individual level. Those that are vulnerable. Just a few years ago, the news was filled with the story of Harmony Montgomery in New Hampshire. Harmony was a 5-year-old girl who went missing. They still have not found her today. It was later discovered that Harmony's father, actually in a rage, apparently he was convicted of this, murdered his 5-year-old daughter. They can't find her remains, but he has been imprisoned. Oppression, it occurs in families. It occurs in communities. And these stories of human oppression pain us, especially in a world of instant news and instant awareness of these tragic situations of genocide and racism and sexual abuse and child abuse. The oppression pains us to hear these things. And Solomon is saying, it's been this way for a long time. The sorrow of those who are oppressed, their tears are great. And he's saying, oftentimes in this world, human relationships under the sun are marked by oppression. And so what does he conclude by this? Look at verse 2. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. You say, well, what kind of conclusion is that? But I think if we're honest in our heart and we hear some of these horrific, tragic stories of oppression, we ourselves might say the same thing. It would be better off if they had died. Again, Solomon's just observing life and he's saying, this is the facts under the sun. These are realities. But notice he says, but there's something better than just dying. Look at verse 3. But better than both, the one who has died, is he who has not yet been and who has not seen the evil deeds that are under the sun. He's saying better yet are those that have never experienced oppression. Not having experienced it and died, but those that have never experienced it because they've never had opportunity. They've never been born. And all Solomon is doing is he's describing what Robert Burns, the Scottish poet, had said in his poem, that man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn. You say, Matt, this is heavy stuff. It is. But Solomon wants to bring it to the top of our thinking because what we tend to do in our society with regard to oppression is sweep it under the rug and say, let's forget that. Let's get back to Disney World. Let's forget about that. Let me get back to some distracting entertainment that keeps my mind off this horrible reality of the world in which we live. And Solomon here is not offering a solution. He's not saying suicide is a way out. Don't misunderstand. What he's saying is, let's think about human relations that leave God out of the picture. When people turn from God, this is often the way that we as human beings treat each other. It becomes a power struggle. And you have people who are oppressors and people who are oppressed. In a fallen world where people do not fear God, this is reality. This preacher, Solomon, his great despair over oppression shows that there is a necessity that there be a final reckoning before God. Do you remember that from last week? We read that back at the end of chapter 3, and that there was this injustice. And Solomon's answer to this injustice is this: it's wait. There is a final day of reckoning. And though there are horrible atrocities committed by humans upon other humans under the sun, that nobody gets away with anything, because in the end, God will hold all people accountable. And it's just as Jesus said in Matthew 18. He says, "Woe who causes one of these little ones to stumble. Woe who perpetrates evil as an oppressor on a young child. It would be better that a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the ocean." Why? Because someday they'll stand before God. This is a troubling trend. Would you agree? There's pain, human relationships under the sun marked by oppression. But there's another troubling trend that he brings up, and that's in verses 4 to 6. It's the anxiety of human relations that are marked by competition. Look at verse 4. He says, "Then I saw that all the toil and all the skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor." This also is vanity and a striving after wind. What is envy? Envy is a prideful longing for something that belongs to another. It's looking at what somebody else has and desiring that so much that, one, either I wish they didn't have it and try to tear them down, or else I work harder to get it. It's this kind of competitive spirit. I deserve that, not them. Therefore, I'm going to get it this way. And what Solomon is saying is that all toil and all skill and work come from this kind of human attitude. Now, this is common in the wisdom literature that we read words like all and every. I don't think Solomon's saying every single person in this room is marked by envy. But what he's saying is, but this is a characteristic of humanity. That the reason people work hard and work to get ahead is simply they're in competition with their neighbor. Do you know how we say this in our modern vernacular? We say it keeping up with the Joneses. I can finally use that. We used to have some Joneses in our church, and I could never use that because it was too personal. But now I don't know of any. So keeping up with the Joneses. And Solomon is saying this is what sometimes people are just motivated in their human relationships in this earth. They look across the field and they see the neighbor has something bigger and better, and they think, well, that's what I want. And so that's what causes them to toil so hard and to work, because they're trying to keep up with the Joneses. What kind of things are envied by others? We envy other people's jobs. Oh, if I only had a job like that. I think I need a job like that, that gives me more leisure time, or gives me more money, or gives me more prestige. We envy other people's things, their house. I need a house that is larger like that. I need an automobile that is fast like that. Sometimes we envy other people's position in life. If only I had a spouse like that. You're so lucky. If only I had children like that. Sometimes we envy people's personhood. If only I looked like that. Or if only I had a life like that. Or at least the life they portray on social media. If only that was my life. And so we work and we toil and we engage in self-effort to better ourselves, that we might be able to live in the right neighborhood and drive the right kind of car and meet the right kind of people and be in the right kind of status. And Solomon is saying, this is like life under the sun. When you leave God out of the picture, what else is there? And people, this is how they live their life. Not too long ago, I was speaking with people in our church, and they were telling me that they went to a rather ritzy part of I believe it was in New York, a place in the country. And they went there because they had some friends that kind of frequented this place. They were well-to-do. And they were telling me it was comical because they went to this ritzy place with these well-to-do people and they're interacting with them. And they said that most of the people in that room they're interacting with, they actually aren't satisfied where they are. They're interested in the next ritzy place up the road where they can't go, but that's where the really wealthy people are. And that's what they were talking about. And they told me it was just comical that there was always something to compare yourself with and look for more. And this is the rat race of humanity that people are engaged in when we keep God out of the picture of our lives and live under the sun without fearing God. Now, some people recognize this. They recognize that life tends to be a rat race and it's motivated by competition or envy and keeping up. And so they respond in a different way. And I think this is the logic of verse 5. This is where this verse comes in. Notice it says in verse 5 that the fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. That's a picturesque picture there, right? The fool doesn't toil like the person in verse 4. And by not toiling, he has nothing at all. And so eventually he destroys himself and loses everything to sustain himself. He's almost involved in eating his own flesh. I think the logic that Solomon is giving us here is this, that this is a reaction when people understand, I'm living in a rat race. I'm doing all of this to impress these other people I don't even care about. It's marked by envy and competition. So they say, what's the use? I'm just going to do nothing. I'm going to be slothful. It's kind of like the battle between father and the son, and the father who works long hours and late nights and gets ahead in the world and accomplishes so much, and his son is lazy and does nothing, and the father comes to him and says, what's your problem? You don't do anything, and you'll never achieve anything in life. And the son looks at the father and says, well, if achieving in life is having what you have, all anxiety and nothing, you can have it. And the son's response is, I'd rather live under a bridge somewhere. I'm just going to do nothing. You're looking for retirement. I'm going to retire now. And Solomon again is giving us this picture. You have people that are competitive in their relationships, and then some respond with just slothfulness. But notice verse 6. He says, but better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Here Solomon does give a solution. He says the better approach is this, modest earning, one handful, not two. Quietness of spirit, a peaceful heart, and not an anxious soul. Solomon says that person always striving, looking to grasp with two hands, motivated by envy. They're filled with anxiety. It's always the next thing. The slothful person that folds his hands and basically waits for all of his things to run out will be filled with anxiety. How am I to live? He says, here's the best thing. Recognize contentment. I have one hand of what I need and quietness in my soul. This involves working hard. But it's being satisfied in what I have and not more than what I need. And I'm able also to help others. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, the New Testament comments on this. And in commenting on this, it says, here is how we are to view life, a good work ethic as God's people. We are to work hard to support ourselves. We are to be diligent in that. We are to be quiet. That is, we are not to be grasping after other things with an envious heart. And then we ought to have sufficient things. And if God gives us more than we need, we have the joy of sharing with those who have need. And this is the biblical picture. And Solomon says this is the better way. But when you leave God out of the picture, our lives are often marked by anxiety. The anxiety of human relations marked by competition. But there's a third troubling trend in the passage. Look at verse 7. The third is this. It's the tragedy of human relations marked by selfish gain. Look at verse 7. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? He says, this also is vanity and an unhappy business. Here's the tragedy of human relations marked by selfish gain. We're introduced to a solitary individual. I don't think the point is that this man wanted son or brother, whatever the case may be, and couldn't have it. I think the point of it is this. If you notice his motivation, there's no end to all of his toil. His eyes are never satisfied. This is the guy who works himself to his fingers to the bone and never finds time for relationship. He's looking for selfish gain. He's always striving for the next thing, the next toy, the next experience, and he never stops and thinks about the value of sharing that with somebody else. This is the man or woman with a garage full of toys. All the ATVs you can imagine, sports car, the snowmobile. Not that there's anything wrong in and of themselves, but this is the guy that's what's really important to him. This is the person that all their life has striven to get ahead and stepped on others along the way, finally to get to the top. Finally, when they get to the top, they realize that it's lonely there and realize that they've missed out really on what life is all about. And what Solomon is warning us in this passage is about a selfish kind of gain in our heart that we want to strive. Our eyes are never satisfied. Again, contentment comes into play with this. And he says there's a tragedy that someone that always has that focus before them, they never look around them and realize all the wonderful things around them because they're selfish and self-focused. This is a tragedy. And so Solomon here gives a solution. Look at verse 9. You can almost read at the beginning of verse 9, doesn't this guy realize two are better than one? Why? Because they have a good reward for their toil. One, with regard to this man that works so hard and yet has no relationships. He says, at the very least, doesn't this guy realize that if two people toil together, the gains are better? Two people can accomplish much more than one. At least there's that. And then he talks about the advantages of two rather than one. And when you read verses 10 down through verse 12, you need to think in terms of an ancient journey. That when people went on a journey in ancient times, it wasn't you just hop into your air-conditioned minivan and drive 1,000 miles and it's somewhat pleasant. It's actually very dangerous. It's actually marked by fear because you might come across bandits, which was common occurrence. It might be marked by deprivation because there are cold nights and you're going to have to spend several nights if you're making any kind of significant journey. And so he says, just think about how two are better than one in terms of a journey. Look at verse 10. If you're on a journey and if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not other to lift him up. One thing that two are better than one at is restoration. If somebody slips and falls in a pit on a journey, you've got somebody else there to help, or at least go for help. And he says that's an advantage. That would not only be true physically on a journey, is it not also true in our lives? Even metaphorically, that if you have fallen, isn't it better to have somebody who loves you and cares about you to come alongside to help you and try to encourage you. He talks about provision. Look at verse 11. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? He's not speaking of marriage here. There's nothing erotic in the passage. What he's really speaking of is a necessary provision. Think of a cold night in a tent. And if you're going to freeze that night, even if it's two guys in the tent, one of the ways to keep from freezing at least is to go back to back and try to get a little warmth, right? And this is what he's saying. It's like a journey. There's provision. If you have two, at least you're going to stay warm for the night. This is the idea of relational comfort, I think, can be drawn from this. And then finally, he says this in verse 12, "And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." This is protection, one to help you in times of trouble. If you're on that journey and a bandit comes, it's going to be much harder for him to overcome two, and especially three. Someone has said this, "Friendship or companionship doubles your joys and divides your sorrows." And this is what Solomon is talking about here. There's a tragedy of living humanity with my blinders on and thinking, what can I gain? What can I suck out of this life for my own enjoyment? He says, better is to look around and think about the people that you need in this life. God did not make us independent. He made us dependent. We're relational people. And that's better. Finally, he says this in verse 13. Now notice he begins with the better. Before he's been ending with that. Now he begins with that in verse 13. He says, "Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice." Here's the better condition, that humility is better than pride or fame sometimes, right? The point is going to be this, the vanity of human relationships marked by fame. But what he says in verse 13 is this, "Better is this poor youth who is wise than an old crotchety king who can't take advice." We would say it this way, "Better is the young person who seeks instruction and follows in the ways of those that have gone before him than somebody who is old and stuck in their ways." You ever been stuck in your ways? Sometimes the older we get, the more stuck in our ways we get. And he's saying, better is one who is poor, has this disadvantage, but yet they're wise because they're open. This is the better condition, but if you'll look at verse 14, he further describes this young youth. He says in verse 14, "For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's palace. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him." He says, surely this is vanity and striving after wind. What is he saying? He's saying, so better is this poor youth than the stubborn old king. And then he describes, he says, this poor youth, because he was wise, he grew to a prominent position. He became king in the kingdom. And we're told that in verse 16, there was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. It's a real rags to riches story, and people recognized his fame. But look at the end of verse 16. "Yet those who come later will" what? "Will forget him. They'll not rejoice. He'll be forgotten." He achieved a measure of fame from this rags to riches kind of story, yet in the end, nobody remembers him. I wonder if Solomon had Joseph in mind. Joseph, the poor Israelite in prison because of his wisdom, was exalted to the second in command of Egypt. And then yet we're told after Joseph had died that there was a Pharaoh who came to power who didn't know who? Joseph. And apparently all the people with him had forgotten about him. And what Solomon is saying is there's a vanity of human relationships marked by fame. If you're living just to make a name for yourself and have fame for yourself, that's empty. It's vanity in these relationships. This is vapor. So here's Solomon's description of the human relationships that we have under the sun. When you leave God out of the picture, they're often marked by oppression or competition or selfish gain or personal fame. And all of those things are empty and pointless. And this chapter does extol the virtues of human relationships, like we've seen in verses 9 through 12. But it warns of expecting too much from human relationships under the sun. That we are all fallen. And I want you to think of your relationships right now that you have with people. Do any of them tend to slip into these categories? I think there's a tug at our heart in some of these things where we have to recognize it's there, maybe to one degree or another, by God's grace I'm overcoming. But I can see that. Our relationships tend to easily slip into these ways of viewing life as about me and not about God and living for His glory under the sun. And so how do you avoid this? How do you avoid this pain and anxiety and tragedy and vanity? You avoid it this way. You must focus on the most important relationship you have. That is a relationship with your Creator. Because that is a relationship that does ultimately satisfy. The reason human relationships tend to slip into these categories is because we're looking for too much out of the relationship. We're looking for that person or that thing or this position ultimately to satisfy, and therefore I approach it entirely in a wrong direction. It's not until you fear God and have a relationship with Him and you are ultimately satisfied with Him that you're not looking for something in the relationships you have on earth, but you're able to give something because you're properly imaging your Creator. Does that describe you this morning? Are you satisfied with God and your relationship with Him? That therefore you don't slip into these categories? You must cultivate a close relationship with God, and there's only one way to do that. You must do it through Jesus Christ, because Jesus said, "Nobody comes to the Father but by me." Have you ever come to Jesus Christ for forgiveness of your sin that you might have a relationship with God? That's the only way. And once you do that and you are brought to relationship with God through Jesus Christ and find satisfaction in Him, then you can enjoy life and the human relationships that God gives you. C.S. Lewis said it this. He said, "When first things are put first, second things are not suppressed, but increased." When first things are put first, my relationship with God, and that's what's most important, and that's where I'm focused. Second things, relationships with others, are not decreased, but they're rather increased. And I think this is the point that Solomon is making to us in this fourth chapter of Ecclesiastes. Let's bow together as we pray.